Top stories this hour. The US is reportedly considering the resumption of sales of offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia ahead of a visit by President Biden to Riyadh. China calls on the Southeast Asian countries to avoid being used as, quote, chess pieces by big powers, saying many countries in the region are under pressure to take sides. The remains of 50 newly identified victims of Srebrenica genocide are buried as thousands of people in Bosnia-Herzegovina mark the 27th anniversary of the massacre. Hello and welcome to World News. Thank you for joining us. The United States is reportedly considering the resumption of sales of offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia ahead of a visit by President Joe Biden to Riyadh this week. The discussions are reportedly at an early stage and a decision hinges on Saudi Arabia ending the war in Yemen. That was what Biden pledged during the early months of his presidency. But his administration has continued to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, which rights groups say were used to commit war crimes in Yemen. The US is facing surging fuel prices and inflation. Washington and its Western allies have called on Riyadh to increase oil production to ease soaring prices that have taken a heavy toll on their economies. A founding member of the Saudi opposition National Assembly Party has been killed in Lebanon. The party says Mani al-Yami was assassinated in suspicious circumstances on Saturday. It has called for a just and transparent probe into his death, accusing Saudi authorities of failing to protect citizens seeking freedoms abroad. Yami was living in Lebanon since 2015. He helped found the National Assembly Party, which was established in exile in 2020. It seeks an elected parliament in the autocratic Saudi Arabia. Hitmen acting under the Saudi crown prince killed dissident Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey in 2018 as well. China has urged Southeast Asian countries not to allow big powers to take advantage by using them as chess pieces. We discussed the Beijing's warnings during our news review program. Let's take a listen.
China's urging Southeast Asian countries to avoid being used as chess pieces by big powers. Chinese foreign minister says that the region is at risk of being reshaped by geopolitical factors. Wang Yi says that many countries are under pressure to take sides. He stressed that the region should be protected from geopolitical calculations and coercion. He made those comments in a meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, in Jakarta. Wang Yi also talked about Taiwan, warning about what he called illusions about separating the island from China. Beijing is locked in dispute with Washington over its military and diplomatic support for Taiwan. Now let's ask for some insights. So joining me will be a couple of guests. We'll have Emmanuel Pasreich, who's the president of Asia Institute in Seoul. Also, Andrew Leung, independent China specialist, who joining me from Hong Kong. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now let's ask Emmanuel about what's going on. And your overall, let's put this into perspective, what we just heard. We have the Chinese official talk about coercion, pressure, other countries being used as chess pieces and all that. Let's put this into perspective.
Right. Well, I think we should see Foreign Minister Wang's statement in the context of the recent NATO summit, June 28th to 30th, in which pressure was put on many countries to sort of expand NATO into a global sort of world army. And the big thrust is now in Asia, and in Japan, Korea, but especially in also in Southeast Asia, to try and force the nations to line up against China and Russia for the sort of imagined world war. Wang Yi is correct in this respect in criticizing this effort by global powers. I wouldn't say it's necessarily exclusively the United States for that matter, but to try and create this unnecessary conflict. However, there are clear weaknesses on the Chinese part, because China is itself a global power and has had extensive influence over Southeast Asia as well. But I think recent events, things have really shifted, so that NATO and the United States have just gone too far.
Let's see how some people have commented on social media. Gentlemen, we'll come back to the rest of the conversation with you. Okay, we have the first one saying that, well, the U.S. tacitly does support Taiwan's independence from China. The only reason it doesn't say so publicly is to avoid prompting China to invade. Biden has made it crystal clear to the Chinese that the United States will get involved militarily if China invades Taiwan. Second post goes, the U.S. will try Taiwan first. If that line of operations cannot provoke China, then it will double down on ASEAN with South China Sea. But of course, ASEAN is not like DPP or SCOMO, U.S. lapdog. Previous attempts on Tibet, Hong Kong, and Xinjiang failed. Okay, then we have another one saying that the U.S. wants to start a war between China and Taiwan. South Korea and Japan will get involved. Millions of Asian lives will be lost while the whites are safe across the Pacific. Asians lose, the U.S. wins. Don't let the U.S. provoke you. And the fourth one saying that China does not need wars of territorial conquest. China thinks only about protecting its economic interests. If China were to be forced into war, it would take Taiwan, and just to show that U.S. hegemony in Asia is over. Okay, back to our conversation. We had some comments that are interesting to discuss a little bit. Now, Andrew, the Chinese foreign minister also talked about some countries that are being forced into taking sides. Which countries, Andrew, is he talking about, and how would they be impacted in case anything goes wrong and we witness an escalation?
I think that the latest initiative, American initiative in Southeast Asia, must be seen in the context of this global campaign to demonize China, to contain China, to confront China, allying its friendly nations in Europe and also in other parts of the world. For example, President Biden's paying a visit to the Middle East, but also in Southeast Asia. And the idea is that the United States could form a global alliance of so-called democracies. For example, the United States is talking about a G10 of democratic countries, or G12, to contain China. But the irony is that in Southeast Asia, all the countries, including other parts of the world, very few countries want to take sides, especially in Southeast Asia, when the ASEAN countries, together with their main trading partners, have established the world's largest trading bloc called the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, with China at front and center of the regional supply and value chain. And in fact, 130 countries around the world, 130 countries around the world, have China as the largest trading partner, compared with only 57 for the United States. So these countries, they don't want to form a bloc with China, but they don't want to take sides. And I don't think that the United States will be very successful in convincing the Southeast Asian countries to ally with the United States to oppose China. Of course, they do not want to be at China's coattail. They want their own independent policy. But on the other hand, they don't want to form a bloc, anti-China bloc, with the United States.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Emmanuel Pesrash in Seoul, Andrew Leung in Hong Kong.
Bosnian Muslims are holding funeral for 50 more victims of a massacre committed by Bosnian Serb forces during the 1919s Bosnian War.
Allahu Akbar.
The remains of the newly identified victims lay to rest on the 27th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre, the world's worst genocide since the World War II. In a statement, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said the tribute to the victims, saying, quote, "Europe failed and we are faced with our shame." In July 1995, around 8,000 Bosnian Muslims, men and boys, were systematically massacred by Bosnian Serb forces and buried them in mass graves. According to the Missing Persons Institute of Bosnia-Herzegovina, some 1,200 people are still missing. About 100,000 people, mostly Muslims, were killed during the 1992-1995 inter-ethnic Bosnian War. Kiev says at least three people have been killed in Russian shelling of Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkiv. The mayor of the northeastern city says the strikes targeted civilian buildings. Local officials say dozens of people were also injured. Meanwhile, Ukraine's state emergency service said the death toll from Saturday's strikes on the eastern city of Chasiv Yar rose to 26. Earlier, Kiev asked civilians in the Russia-controlled southern region of Kherson to urgently evacuate. The call followed reports that the Ukrainian army forces were preparing to attack there. Ukraine lost control of most of the Black Sea region in the first weeks after Russia launched its military offensive in Ukraine on February 24th. Thousands of people have been killed and over 6 million have left Ukraine. This is the biggest armed conflict in Europe since World War II. Our correspondent Johnny Miller is following the war in Ukraine, explains why Kiev is inclined to launch attacks on the Russia-controlled southern Kherson region. He says people there have mixed opinions about Russia, unlike the Donbass region, which has an overwhelmingly Russian-speaking population. Let's take a listen.
In the east of Ukraine, where I am, in Donbass, you have an overwhelming pro-Russian majority here who've been fighting Ukrainian nationalists for 8 years. They very much want to be independent or join Russia. In the southern region around Kherson, I've been to the part of that region. It's a bit more complicated. It's a lot more mixed. It's not this overwhelming Russian majority that there is in the east. And that's also why you see some insurgent attacks by Ukrainians against newly appointed Russian officials, because there's a lot more pro-Ukrainians in those regions. So Ukraine is, there's some sort of suggestion that Ukraine may well want a peace deal that allows the East to join Russia, but it's that southern region which Ukraine is desperate to take back because there's so many pro-Ukrainians there. They feel at least that region they have to try and take back. So the Ukraine government has said that they want to launch attacks. They've tried to launch attacks on Kherson before unsuccessfully. So this may well be a precursor, asking civilians to leave there, a statement of Ukraine's intentions to try and forcibly take back the southern region. Russia, though, stands very firm. They've been moving forward in Donbass, and they seem very confident they'll be able to repel any Ukrainian attack.
French President Emmanuel Macron is under pressure to explain his support for taxi app Uber while he was economy minister. This after thousands of leaked files exposed how the American service provider used ethically dubious and potentially illegal tactics during its aggressive global expansion. Investigations showed that Macron held several undeclared meetings with Uber executives between 2014 and 2016. According to the files, Uber struck a secret deal with Macron on the regulation of the company's services at a time when it was upending the traditional taxi market. They also show how the firm's former boss personally ordered to use of a so-called kill switch to prevent raiding police from accessing computers. Documents revealed that Uber also received extensive help from other top politicians, including former EU Commissioner Neelie Kroes. Macron and the company have not denied the allegations. Skepticism abounds in the EU around the idea that relations between the 27-nation bloc and Britain will improve once Prime Minister Boris Johnson leaves office. Brussels and London remain at loggerheads over post-Brexit trading arrangements relating to Northern Ireland. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital, Brussels.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland.
The political developments do not change our position on the protocol or the way in which we work with our British counterparts on Northern Ireland. Our position is that we should endeavour to seek solutions on the implementation of the protocol, and that's it.
The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace, just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic.
The new Prime Minister will carry on more or less the same policy as Boris Johnson, with one difference that maybe he would be a bit more honest with British citizen.
Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but it didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much, unless there's a snap election and then, say, like Labour take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Japanese government has called for a probe into the security loopholes in the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Chief Cabinet Secretary Matsuno says the government has received a report suggesting fault in the security and guard system. Abe was fatally shot while speaking at a campaign event in the western city of Nara on Friday. The suspect is in custody and has confessed to assassinating Abe. The shooter mentioned Abe's alleged ties to a religious organization linked to the bankruptcy of his family. Abe's killing has drawn condemnations from world leaders.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
The recent BRICS meeting hosted by China was a big event. Five countries not only pledged closer ties, but the Chinese president even encouraged other countries to join the bloc. Iran and Argentina applied, as BRICS turned into a grouping that is against the West and its financial grip, from monetary systems to trade. Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwai, and that is just one of the angles we'll be covering in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in the program, the BRICS countries, 40% of the world's population, 26% of the global economy, and $27.5 trillion in economic might. Next, we're going to take a look at the BRICS expansion. As we just mentioned, Iran and Argentina have applied for membership. Also looking at emerging market alternative to the West. That is something that the Chinese President Xi Jinping has encouraged. And finally, one of the other highlights of today's program, China and Russia to have leveled criticism against Western and the U.S. abuse of sanctions
The Ukraine crisis, a wake-up call, warning against expanding military alliances.
The BRICS group of nations have just held the 14th summit hosted by China. The group, which owes its name to the initials of its five member states, namely Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. BRICS nations have a combined population of 3.23 billion, and the combined GDP is more than $23 trillion. China has by far the largest economy in the BRICS grouping, accounting for more than 70% of the group's collective economic might. India accounts for about 13%, with Russia and Brazil each accounting for about 7%. The group has attained more significance following the war in Ukraine. The group is now seen as an emerging bulwark against U.S. global hegemonic ambitions. The group is trying to boost multilateral cooperation with non-Western styles, forms, and principles.
The New Development Bank is present there in a whole range of sectors. I look, for example, our projects in wind energy in China, solar energy projects that we have in Brazil. We can say that the New Development Bank is contributing its share, closed the gap between the needs of infrastructure and sustainability in the emerging world and the resources that should be there available to finance these great projects.
The social media content on the BRICS countries was in some way even more than the actual media coverage, which shows how the West may be concerned about this grouping, which represents about 26% of the world's GDP. Well, first post is what the Chinese President Xi Jinping has said. Chinese President Xi Jinping on the 14th BRICS summit, it is important that BRICS countries support each other on issues concerning core interests, practice true multilateralism, safeguard justice, fairness, and solidarity, and reject hegemony, bullying, and division. Next up, BRICS countries certainly bring more positive, stabilizing, and constructive strength to the world. And a comparison was in this particular tweet, and stat-wise, it is apparent how BRICS outweighs the G7 group of countries, especially when it comes to the GDP. When you take a look at that, 26% versus 16%. And, of course, the other stats speak for themselves in comparison. Next up, people are taking notice of the relevance of BRICS, given that the two countries have applied for membership, namely Iran and Argentina, which was covered in this tweet. So that shows that that's actually being recognized. And then moving on to this one, in the past 16 years, constantly have we heard that BRICS cannot be sustained, time tells. And then it goes on to make a comparison between BRICS and security groupings. Here you can see BRICS standing for real multilateralism versus Cold War mentality, the security grouping, and then BRICS, how it focuses on global development versus the security grouping's focus on exploiting developing countries, and of course the other factors as you see here. All right, so that was that comparison. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program, Glenn Diesen. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Southeastern Norway, who joins us. Glenn Diesen, welcome. When you take a look at the BRICS countries, they are a major economic, obviously, force, accounting for 40% of the world's population and 26% of the global economy. Now, China, by far, has the largest economy in this grouping, leading the way, accounting for more than 70% of it. But other countries are hoping to do better. Russia and Brazil, for example, they each account for 7%, and that may increase. Do you think that the BRICS countries is making a huge comeback, given the fact that you're looking at the Ukraine conflict and some of the geopolitical shifts worldwide that's taking place?
It's that the reason it's become so relevant that it's come back into this fold is because it's a response to the unipolar order, which is becoming more and more unfeasible and also declining. So the unipolar order is effectively the international economy organized around the United States and also the collective West. So what we've been seeing over the past few years is simply that there's an emergence of new technologies, which are not in the West. Across this BRICS country, you have new industries, new transportation corridors, there's new banks, there's more use of local currencies. So BRICS kind of represents, it's a way of organizing, if you will, this new diversified economic connectivities.
All right, let me introduce our next guest, Kim Do-ju. He is a political analyst, a senior fellow at Pangol institution. He's also adjunct professor at Renmin University of China, and he joins us from Beijing, China. Qin Dezhu, welcome. The Chinese president has actually criticized the abuse of international sanctions, in particular, obviously making reference to the U.S. there. The Ukraine crisis, he also added, is a wake-up call for the world. And he also warned against these expanding military alliances, which is obviously a reference to NATO. What do you think about how BRICS used to be viewed, its contribution to the world economy, and how that has increased, and now with the Ukraine conflict, perhaps it's more relevant, and showing how alignments are shifting towards the East, perhaps, in some sense?
Well, I think, you know, as a group, as I said, the more represent this balancing power, I would say, to this current international system, which is dominated by Washington and Brussels. This is not balanced. This is not not fair, let's say, to the to this developing world. So there's a need, there's a long-term need to be fairly represented and to govern the international community or international global governance, let's say. Reform to the global governance is necessary. And with the rise of the developing world, I think, of course, they will defend their interests, they will have their voice heard.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program, where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Our first stop, Ghana. Ghana to make a U-turn and actually asked IMF for help for its economy. Ghana had refused to seek the IMF support to rescue an economy that's been crippled by the pandemic, rampant inflation, and also a depreciating currency. Protests have actually gone against the government, and they've spiraled in some places out of control, in particular inflation, to have taken place also to lead to the protests. The growth has been slowed to 3.3% year-on-year, and inflation a record 27.6% for the month of May. Next up, recession alarm bells. Asia's manufacturing has slowed. That has added to the global recession fears. Factory activity slowing or declining in countries like Japan, South Korea, and in Taiwan amid supply disruptions and also rising costs. Now, China's manufacturing activity, here's the interesting part, expanded at its fastest pace in 13 months for the month of June, as the lifting of COVID lockdowns sent factories racing to meet robust demand. Well, sharp economic slowdown risks in Europe, however, and then the United States, or maybe together at once, have reinforced fears of a global recession. So we can see how that is also gripping the world, what's happening in Europe and the States. Next up, we're going to take a look at ruble power. Yes, right, Russia demanding rubles for now grain exports. Moscow has expanded the list of commodities that must be paid for in the Russian currency. Obviously, the ruble is going to keep on doing better now that that has been added to the list. The Russian government has added also grain, sunflower oil, and it has extracted meal, a category that it calls, to the list of exports. Now, Russia is the world's largest wheat exporter and a major supplier of sunflower seeds. So still, the ramifications of the Ukraine conflict are at play. Our final stop in the U.S. and the stock markets there. Now, U.S. stocks are off to their worst start in over 50 years. The S&P 500, for example, ended first half of 2022 lower by 20.6%. Lots of losses there. And the Dow Jones has also been at the receiving end of the losses, down 15.3% this year, marking its worst first half performance since the year 1962, if you can believe that. Well, investors obviously are grappling with the risks of an economic downturn and also tighter monetary policy. Those are the four items that we picked.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for an in-depth section of the program. Well, when it comes to the BRICS group of countries, there is certainly a union between these countries in how, as one, they present a powerful economic force, which contributes a lot to the world economy as a result. There's no doubts about that, along with other groupings, blocs, and alliances. Well, the BRICS countries, well, the numbers speak for themselves. The world population, 41%. The world GDP, 24%. That's how much they contribute to the world GDP. That's almost a quarter of the world GDP. In terms of the global GDP, the value, $24.44 trillion. And in terms of the world trade, 16% there. Also, the global economic growth is 50% that it has contributed to. And this block of countries comprised of five countries, two to have applied for membership, Iran and Argentina. Goldman Sachs, the powerful brokerage firm out of the U.S., has said BRICS can become bigger than the G7 by the year 2035. That's not that far away. So that shows how powerful this grouping of countries is. All right, let's move on to the next grouping of countries. It's called the EAEU or the EAU, the Eurasia Economic Union. It is comprised of five countries, all of them in a single market, of which it has 184 million people in that market. And the combined GDP is $5 trillion. So this group of countries is something to take a note of. Now, moving on next, the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Now, when you take a look at the SCO, this is the world's largest regional organization in terms of the numbers that it stands for of the countries. The land mass itself is pretty evident of that, 60% of Eurasia land mass. And in terms of the world population, it represents 40% of it. And when it comes to the global GDP, 30% is here. So Iran is also one of the countries because last year it became a permanent member the last time that they met. All right, now let's move on to another grouping of countries. This grouping is actually also very important, and it's called the RCEP. What does it stand for? Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement, comprised of members with a world population of 15 members in total, the world population coming in at 30%, 2.2 billion people, okay? So obviously a big grouping of countries in this particular block. The global GDP stands at second, and this is quite a bit since it's the largest grouping of countries, at $29.7 trillion, okay? And therefore, it is no surprise that it holds the number one spot as being the world's largest trade bloc. That's right. And what is the most significant factor in all of these trading blocks, now that we've covered some of them? It's the fact that the U.S. is not a member. I repeat, not a member, which shows how the U.S. has, in some ways, isolated itself on the world stage when it comes to trade. Okay, let's bring back our guest for Q&A here. We have Glenn Deason, professor of international relations at the University of Southeastern Norway, rejoining us. Glenn Deason, welcome back. Iran, holding the world's second largest gas reserves, has applied for membership of the BRICS group of countries, along with Argentina. China has said that it wants other emerging economies to actually join this bloc, which was exclusively between the five countries, and would like to shape the BRICS agenda in line with its China-centric initiatives. No surprise there. Do you think Western policies and other systems emanating from the West have failed when it comes to why BRICS is now emerging so powerfully?
Well, yes, it has. I mean, if you look through history, liberal economic systems, so opening up trade and the cooperation between states, tend to organize under economic hegemons, so dominant economies, because they take on the role to administer the global economy, you know, because they have the technologies, the industries, the infrastructure, you know, bank and dominant currencies, and they can set the standards. So what we usually see is that the economic hegemon is to have an interest in creating trust in such a system, which is centered around them. So that is kind of the incentive. The problem is a hegemon in decline. It becomes more and more likely to abuse this administrative position in the economy. So it weaponizes this control over the economy to strike down against adversaries, to protect its declining position.
All right. Let's have Kindo Zhu join us. He's a political analyst who joins us from Beijing in China. Kindo Zhu, welcome back. BRICS accounting for more than 40% of the world population and 26% of the global economy. You have other alliances also, such as the EAEU or RCEP in your part of the world, and also taking a look at the SCO. of which China is a major member of those alliances. But let's focus on BRICS in terms of its contribution. Countries like Russia and Brazil each accounting for about 7%, along with the contributions made by the other countries. It was once dismissed as a grouping, but now it has come back, and it is said to stand as a bulwark against the U.S. and the West. Do you see it that way?
Well, I think if you look at the past several years, you know, since the start of the Trump regime, let's say 2016, you know, Trump launched the trade war, tech war, and a series of like wars, quote unquote, not only against China, but also against the Europeans and even its close neighbors like Canada and Mexico. So in that sense, you know, the U.S. has adopted a policy that is prioritize its domestic interests. Of course, U.S. has always been doing that, including this current U.S. government under Biden, for example. But for Trump, it's more standing out about the U.S., you know, America First policy. In that sense, you know, that's a huge, huge devastation to the global trade, let's say, the multipolar, multilateral system. For example, the WTO, the U.S. has more or less paralyzed this very important multilateral trade organization, and the U.S. has imposed the tariffs even today. You know, we are talking about billions and billions of Chinese goods. You know, this is a huge blow to this globalization.
The expanding influence of BRICS has encouraged other nations to join the economic and political bloc. Iran and Argentina have both applied for memberships. China has actually encouraged other countries, especially emerging nations, to join the bloc. In the case of Iran, it holds the world's second largest gas reserves. Its membership in BRICS would result in added values for both sides.
And leaders and foreign ministers reached a very important consensus to start promoting the discussions on the membership expansion issue. And we will start to identify the criteria and the principles, guidelines on this issue. China's intention is to keep it open, and we'd like to see that new members can come in. I do not have a timeline for this, but it's really based on the consensus of all BRICS countries.
BRICS countries have agreed that it is important to step up cooperation with other emerging markets and developing countries in order to improve the representation of the BRICS mechanism and make it loudly heard on major international issues. This will help to better rise up to challenges and to uphold the interests of emerging markets and developing countries.
وليس التركيز على اتجاه واحد. أحادي القطب هو ما جعل أن هناك عدة مشاكل اقتصادية في العالم والتي نلاحظها الآن إن كانت بالأسعار المرتفعة إن كان في أسعار الطاقة والنفط وإن كان أيضا في المواد الغذائية والمواد الأولية. اتجاه الرئيس الصيني بأن يكون هناك عدة أقطاب إلى الاقتصاد وأن يكون هناك اقتصاد منفتح وليس مغلق بأن لا يكون هناك تأثير سياسي على الاقتصاد بشكل مباشر.
Iran's potential membership to the BRICS group would be a severe blow to U.S. attempts to isolate Iran ever since the victory of the Islamic Republic. Washington has tried to ostracize Iran through various ways, including sanctions and threats. Iran has recently made great leaps in its foreign policy. It is now a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and has applied for membership to the Eurasia Economic Union. Both of them are non-U.S.-led organizations that seek to counter the hegemony of the West. BRICS members, along with countries like Argentina and Iran, are a group of emerging economies that can evolve as an engine of global growth, which means that Western countries will be left behind as a result.
When it comes to the recent BRICS meeting, the role that this grouping plays in the world economy was highlighted again. But there was something very different about what this grouping represented as reflected through what the Chinese president said. What was another key highlight from Xi's four-point proposal on pursuing high-quality development of BRICS cooperation? These three were pretty significant. First, He said we need to speak out for equity and justice, to encourage the international community to practice true multilateralism, urging the world to reject the Cold War mentality and block confrontation, oppose unilateral sanctions, and abuse of sanctions. The need to pool strength for economic recovery, to step up macro policy coordination, to keep industrial and supply chains secure and unclogged, to build an open world economy, and to forestall and diffuse major risks and challenges in global development. And finally, to advocate sustainable and people-centered development, invest more in poverty alleviation, food, education, health, and so on, and promote the implementation of the UN's 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. China has made it a point to set the stage in many of the previous topics discussed, and therefore it is no surprise that its governance model is what he believes is a successful one, which is non-Western.
The one impressed me most is the last few sentences made by President Xi, the emphasis of mutual benefit, cooperation, and win-win situation among the BRIC countries. This is very important because now the world is suffering because a BRIC country is trying to maintain its superpower.
This entry explains this fully. At BRICS Summit, China set stage to tout its governance model, where the bloc of emerging economies were praised for promoting non-Western styles, forms, and principles. It went on to say that boosting multilateral cooperation with non-Western styles, forms, and principle is of utmost importance, stressing the importance of the bloc at a time when the U.S. is pulling its Western allies to rebel against globalization.
As a developing country, Thailand looks forward to cooperating with BRICS countries, especially in terms of science and technology transfer and cooperation, technical training. I think BRICS has been very important in helping to promote cooperation, especially among emerging and developing countries.
And that does it for my segment.
In today's program, we brought you the relevance of BRICS, and I think we've done okay in terms of telling you how big a bloc that is, along with the other trading blocs and alliances, which show how much the world is shifting in terms of those alliances getting closer and doing trade amongst themselves. And we did mention that these blocs do not have the U.S. as a member, but there's a bigger reason for that, and that is the way that the U.S. has carried itself in its foreign policy endeavors. Sanctions to be one of them, of which the Chinese President Xi Jinping said that that is just counterproductive, especially for the world economy to grow, preventing that from happening. That is the main focus in what I want to leave you with, because obviously the U.S. is being left behind when it comes to the economics of the world and how it's preventing that to progress. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. From Mikavi Tahwe, it's goodbye until next time.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
هيهات أنت أكرم من أن تضيع من ربيتك
من أدنيت أو تشرد من أعويت أو تسلم إلى البلاء من كفيته ورحمت.
Dear listeners, as you have been previously with us, we were discussing this excerpt of the Kumail's application. Hayhat, أنت أكرم من أن تضيع من ربيته. Far be it from you. You are more generous than torturing him whom you have nurtured. أو تبعد من أدنيته. Or to banish him whom you have brought up. أو تشرد من آويته. Or to drive away him whom you have given an abode. أو تسلم إلى البلاء من كفيته ورحمته. Or submit to tribulation him whom you have spared and shown mercy. We said that from the beginning of creating a human till his death time, the Almighty has put him under his grace, under his mercy. Different material and spiritual blessings have been showering upon mankind only to make him love the Almighty Allah. Now, it has appeared in the Islamic sources that love is so important and belief is nothing but love. Imam Baqir alayhi salam has said, belief is love and hatred. Iman is made up of hub and bughd, or love and hatred. It is also reported from Fudail bin Yasar. I asked Abu Abdullah Imam Sadiq alayhi salam about love and hatred, whether they are part of belief. And he alayhi salam replied, and is Iman other than love and hatred? This is also what Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says. Is religion other than love? Allah the Almighty, the Majestic says, say, if you love Allah, then follow me. Allah will love you. فَاتَّبِعُونِي يُحْبِبْكُمُ اللَّهِ. And it is only in this case that a servant experiences the sweetness and pleasure of the heart while talking to his Lord. This is what the commander of the believers is showing us in this part.
Oh my God, my Master, my Lord, and my Nourisher, will you see me punished with the fire kindled by you, despite my belief in your unity, and despite the fact that my heart has been filled with knowledge of you, and when my tongue has repeatedly praised you, and my conscience has acknowledged your love, and despite my sincere confessions and my humble begging submissively made to your divinity. No, indeed you are far too kind and generous to destroy one you nourished and supported, or to drive away from yourself one you have kept under your protection.
Thank you, Allah, that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So we have all been under Almighty Allah's blessing and mercies from the beginning of our creation, even before that. This is what the Holy Quran says, قُلْ مَنْ يَرْزُقُكُمْ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ وَالْأَرْضِ. Say, who gives you sustenance from the heaven and the earth? أَمَّنْ يَمْلِكُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارِ. Who controls the hearing and the sight? Who brings forth the living from the dead and vice versa? And they will all say Allah. So this is so important for the true servant to understand where he is standing, to believe and recognize his own indigence and need, and then bring it to the Lord of the worlds. And when he is talking to the Lord, he's worshipping his Lord out of love, eagerness and yearning. I assume there is no pleasure and sweetness above it. Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, who is among those who had tasted the sweetness of love and remembrance of Allah, says, O Allah, how pleasant is the taste of your love, and how sweet is the drink of your proximity. Now let us end our discussion on this excerpt of the Qumayyah supplication with a narration. The historians have reported that 300 captives were brought to Ma'an ibn Zayda, a great commander of war. That man ordered to kill all of them. A captive boy, who had not reached puberty yet, said, O commander, by Allah, do not kill us before we drink water. Ma'an says, it's okay, let all of them drink water. When they all drank water, the young man told the commander, Commander, now that we have all drank water, all of us are your guests, and greeting the guest is a duty of the noble ones. At this scene, Ma'an said, you are right, and he ordered to free all of those captives. For sure, the commander of the believers, Imam Ali alayhi salam, has informed us it is far away from the beneficent Allah to chastise a servant who has always been a guest of his bountiful blessings. أنت أكرم من أن تضيع من ربيته. We have seen you as the most generous person, so you cannot torture him whom you yourself have nurtured. You have given us a boat. You have brought us up, and you have spared us. You have shown us mercy, so you will not banish us. You will not torture us. You will not drive us away, and you will not submit us to tribulation, because we have been under your mercy from the very beginning. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through half my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.